Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of The Other Truth. Back with us is Glenn Deason. I am on vacation, so I am not in my office with the usual setup, so there may be some sound issues. If, by the way, my voice sounds really odd, I'm fighting with YouTube to keep the language as English instead of it auto delete it started auto defaulting to Russian and doing AI translation of English to English. So no, I do not create AI content. We're all real people. Just because the voices don't fit anymore, it's probably the settings have gone screwed again. I've had people in the last couple of interviews, ah, this is all AI. I was like, this is not AI. And then somebody wrote out, the voice is horrible. Like I'm listening to it, it's like, that's normal. And then what's the checking's like, oh, okay, son of a biscuit eater. Glenn, welcome back. So let me ask you this. Okay, Ukraine is escalating. Well, okay, NATO EU is escalating. Hits on civilian, absolutely civilian infrastructure. No fear in Europe at all. The leadership that sooner or later that the rich who are now being hit in Russia are going to demand strikes back on European corporate assets.
Well, it's hard to say. There's no discussion at all. I think if every now and then you hear some comments, some cautious voice coming along saying, "Well, where is this actually going? What risks are there? What is there a different path which might be wiser?" They're very quickly cut down in size, and you would suggest that, well, if you question any of the NATO policies, then you are essentially, doing carrying water for Putin. This is kind of the argument. So no, there's no discussion at all, and it's quite troubling to be honest, because the political elites have become very, very hawkish, and again, the language they use, the lack of any common sense or the need to explain their position, their willingness to accommodate any dissenting views. I mean, it was not like this during the Cold War. During the Cold War, we could listen to what Moscow was saying. We had proper discussions, debate. We had, discussions. Okay, with what extent do we do deterrence? To what extent do we do reassurance? What is actually Moscow worried about? How can we, reduce Moscow's fears without emboldening it, perhaps? You would have competing perspectives. There's none of that today. It's just whoever is hungry for war, that's one side, and others are traitors. That's it. There's no discussions, and and you can kind of see where this is headed. So it's quite troubling.
Anybody actually wants to wage war and win, not just fantasize about it in your mother's basement, behind a keyboard. Anybody that's actually seriously contemplating that, one of the key issues is know your enemy. I mean, we had this commentary written by Sun Tzu back 2,500 years ago. If you know yourself and you don't know your enemy, you'll win half the time. If you don't know yourself, if you know don't know yourself, but you know your enemy, you'll win half the time. If you don't know yourself or your enemy, you'll never win. I mean, wouldn't one of the concepts would have to be to actually understand the actual structure, mental state, desires of your opponent versus what now? Oh, and we froze up. Glenn? Yep, we froze up.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Glenn? Okay,
Yes.
we're back.
Yeah.
So, from my previous questions on Sun Tzu, what are the Europeans thinking? I mean, if shouldn't they try to understand their opponent, if they want to win, if that's their aim?
Yeah, no, that would make sense. I always make the point that, if you say something, you should understand what the Russians want, and they say, oh, if you try that's pro-Russian, they say, and you can't be pro-Russian. They never explain exactly what pro-Russian mean, but essentially, no, there is no trying to unpack the other side. And again, it doesn't matter if one loves Russia or hates Russia. What is the difference? You should either know. You should put yourself in the shoes of the other side. Again, this is the kind of the point of departure in security studies as well. If you have countries that in conflict, how do you resolve it? Well, first you put yourself in the shoes of the opponent. If you want peace, that's what you have to do. First of all, you have to put yourself in their shoes, find out what are their main security concerns, how can you seek to mitigate these competing security concerns, or manage the competition, whatever it is. If you want to defeat them, you also have to know what is the main concern, what is it that motivates. Again, but there's none of the sort. And so no, it's hard to say. I often, when I was teaching security strategy as well, I used to always teach my student, well, not teach, but tell my students, don't hate your opponents. It tends to cloud your judgment. If everything that your opponent does is because they're evil, they have bad intentions, if you can't formulate a reasonable argument for why the opponent does what it does, if it hurts you so much, then it's you're not capable of analyzing anything. I mean, even Alexei Arestovych made this point, his former advisor to Zelensky, said, if you have been propagandized, a good indication is if you can formulate the position of your opponent. If you're unable to do so, if you know it but you can't make yourself say it out loud, or you don't know, then you've been propagandized. And I think that's a very reasonable position to make, and that's essentially all of society now. There is no the yeah there's no trying to understand the opponent. I remember I once made the point that understanding is different from justifying, because for some reason this was a controversial statement. But in this country, a former defense minister, she when Russia went into Ukraine, she said, this is not the time for understanding, it's the time for condemnation. So this is kind of the mentality. Understanding your opponent is immoral, and but again, not to go too far with this, but I think that's at the heart of the Europeans' problem. When Russia went into Ukraine, every journalist, every politician, they all had to unify under the same mantra: this was unprovoked. Now, this is so very powerful narrative, because if you say it's unprovoked, that is everything that Russia does is just military opportunism. Putin woke up one day, wanted more territory. Now, if this is the case, if it's unprovoked, Russia wants to restore the Soviet Union or whatever nonsense they're saying, then the best thing is, don't do negotiations or diplomacy, because this is to reward your opponent. What you want to do is elevate the costs, so make sure that they're higher than the benefits. So send weapons, don't talk. And this is the mentality. And if you recognize that the opponent has certain security concerns, then you would look at it very differently. If the opponent sees this as an existential threat, and you're elevating, escalating all the time, you're making a mistake, because I keep making the point, you really don't want to, the idea that you can bleed out the Russian economy or bleed out its military. We should pray that we're not successful at this, because then, if Russia faces an existential threat, it will go with the nukes instead. So, but again, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but we will never know, because we don't even have debates anymore. It's just no one should understand the opponent. That's appeasement, and you're making apologies, and you're legitimizing war, and essentially you're snuffed out from any public discussions.
Not understanding your opponent is that's like walking into a boxing match blindfolding, not even knowing what weight category you're going up against or anything of the sort. Does he have four arms? Does he have five arms? Does he have two arms? Is there two of them? Oh, that's insane. And I mean that's something that goes against every single tenet of politics, diplomacy, business. You don't understand the market, you don't understand your competition. How the hell do you do business? It's come to that point. That's ludicrous.
Well, it's not just Russia. It's all opponents. So you're never asked to understand Iranians either. It's just Iranians. It's just that they're religious fanatics. They hate freedom. They hate women rights. It's same with the Chinese. You don't have to understand them. It's just that they're commies, and they don't have our freedoms and our values, and they want to undermine our unity and our liberal democracy. This is all there is. And in my opinion, I think a lot of this can be because we didn't talk like this during the Cold War. We assessed our opponent. We had to know who
Right.
they were, what are their interests, and this is a necessity if you want to understand and try to predict how they will behave, how will they react to what we do. I think this is a remainder of the unipolar moment, because after the Cold War we essentially had the well, I would say an ideology built around the idea of liberal hegemony. That is, we will dominate the world and it will be a force for good. That was NATO.
Right.
Everyone will benefit from our hegemon, and because we look to elevate liberal democratic values, so our only opponents who will resist Western hegemony would be those who hate our values. And so, if you're recognizing that perhaps countries might have legitimate security concerns about this Western obsession with dominating the world, then it essentially undermines the foundation of the whole ideology of liberal hegemon. That there's no legitimate reasons to fear it. This is a force for good. So I think for this reason, since the 90s, we snuffed out all dissenting voices in terms of who might actually be worried about the West building a hegemon, because this is our entire security strategy. That's what it's built up around. Not managing security competition, not taking the security concerns of the opponent into consideration, but dominating, and that dominance will be a force for good. And this is still the thinking.
Okay. So I understand that. But at the end of the day, okay, we take 1984 as a good model. It's got much worse than that. But take 1984. We had the 10 minutes of hate where the crowd comes out there and screams whatever the target of the hate for of the Uniparty is at that moment. And that's fine if that's how you're running your society for the plebs, if you wish to call it that. But for the elites that actually have to make the decisions, have they all bought into the same thing at this point? Because if they have, that's absolutely insane.
Yes, no, it is insane. But it's
Concise, quick answer.
yeah, no, well, but it's a weakness in the human nature as well. That is, human beings are a group animal. The individual could be rational, but when you have that group psychology, it can be quite overwhelming. And when you have an ideology about why no one has legitimate concerns for what you do, it can be quite overwhelming of the rational individual, but also the way dissent is stifled. I mean, if everyone around you, all politicians, all journalists, all say exactly the same, that there is no legitimate concern, then the individual tends to adjust to the group. And I've spoken to former diplomats, politicians who say, yeah, kind of, this is problematic. We did discuss these things in the 90s that something like this would happen. They don't say it in public because they will be crucified. So, I know very well what happens when they say it out loud, because that's what I've done in this country, and you get completely destroyed. You have no every no journalist will ever ask you a question besides whether or not you're taking money from the Kremlin. You have a politicians calling for the use of the security services against you. You have a colleagues turning against you, putting in op-eds about you in the papers. You will have government NGOs, sent after you to cancel every event you speak at, to send letters to your university, try to have you fired. To smear pieces, online campaigns. I mean, all of this. I've done so many rounds of this now. It's getting old. So no, the people have good reasons why they want to be a bit careful to utter themselves, and will try to speak for common sense in the public realm. It can become quite dangerous.
I'm going to take it that Soviet studies or Sovietology that was all over, almost every major university had their own little department, Soviet studies, which basically was Russian studies. So translated in modern Russian studies is non-existent anymore.
No, and I think that's a good point. Considering the Cold War, you did had a you know yes, you had ideological fanatics on actually both sides,
No, yeah,
but
absolutely.
you also had great scholars. You had good programs studying, learning Russian, all of this. But I think after the Cold War, two things happened. One, Russia wasn't seen as being that important anymore. So, and the main logic, as the defense minister of Bill Clinton said, you know, the main objective became simply to manage Russia's decline. You don't need that much Russian expertise for this. Also, the second was, the idea that you didn't need all this knowledge about the history, complexities of the Russian views on the world, because everything became ideological. And again, this goes back to the liberal hegemon. If you listen to the European politicians, for example, or the Americans for that matter, they don't have any expertise in Russia or
No,
China.
no.
But they have ideology, and that informs everything. They are, you know, we have liberal democracy that creates peace. Our opponents, they do not. They want to hold on to power. They are authoritarian, and that's why we have conflict. This is kind of the liberal democratic peace thesis, and this is. That guides everything. You don't need to know anything anymore, because it's good values versus bad values. If the good values do compromise with the bad values, that's called appeasement. So you create peace when the good values triumph over the bad ones. This is it. This is from my perspective the great irony, because after the Cold War, the idea was that liberal democracy would be rooted in the Western hegemony. It would be a way of elevating peace around the world. And it was considered to be a non-zero-sum way of enhancing security, because
Right.
if your neighbor is democratic, we'll be democratic, we'll all have peace. It sounds like a positive-sum game to security, but what it really did was, we say that it's internal character of states that dictate its behavior, and the only variable we measure is liberal democracy. And what you then do is you say that, well, it's good values versus bad. And there's always a tendency to externalize evil. That is, you only see bad in others, not yourself. So how do you then have peace with when you have conflict? You know, if you recognize there's competing security concerns, then you would have mutual understanding, compromise, diplomacy. If you think it's good values versus bad values, how do you have peace? Well, the other side always have the bad values. So it's a bit like a religious fanatic. How do you deal with your opponent? Well, one, you can contain them, and that's kind of what NATO does, or you can convert them, you know, try to make them into liberal democracies, or you can destroy them. That's it. Those are your three options. And we couldn't convert the Russians, we say, and now we can't contain them. So I think it's heading towards the trying to destroy. And I don't see that happening either. So I think, some of our main problems, I think, in the West, it comes from us. We, again, not even being able to discuss the security concern problem, the most basic thing. If you can't do this, you really need to ask some very basic question. But we can't do that. I mean, yes, Russia also has its problems, but you should always be able to look at yourself in the mirror, and we do not do that at all, and that's a huge problem.
It sounds like the Albigensian crusade in 1209, when the heretics are mixed in. They're ruling the cities, but they're mixed in with the Catholics. And the crusaders were asking, "Well, how do we know who we're killing? If we're killing the heretics or the crusaders?" And the church answered back, "Kill them all. God knows his own." It kind of feels like that same. What do we need to understand? Or just kill them all? But that's not an option either. Well, not an
No,
option they can actually make for real, realize. Let me rephrase that.
but at the backdrop of all of this, it's not just a very more an ideological fundamentalist view of looking at the world, but it's also how wars are now seen. Because the Cold War was long gone, and then for decades thereafter, what did war mean? War is, you know, we fought against weak, medium-sized countries in faraway
True.
places. It meant that, for example, look at Iraq. That was a big one, but still, the U.S. could essentially shape the battlefield. It could build up troops all around Iraq. Well, first sanction it, starve it for a decade, and then surround it with troops, build up exactly the favorable position, and then attack. And this was it. Do just bombing campaigns every now and then, these bloody nose attacks with the implicit, we'll bomb you a little bit. If you try to strike back, we'll bomb you hard. And this is so essentially accept the soft bombing we'll do every now and then, unless you want heavy bombing. And then now we enter a new era, that is the return of great power politics, because the hegemon is over. So who do we face now? Russia, Iran, China. And essentially, we don't know what to do, because the Russians are fighting back, the Iranians are fighting back, quite spectacularly so as well. The Americans don't know what to do, because they are, destroying all their bases in the region. They don't know how to defeat the Iranians. And of course, once, which w won't happen, if they're able to defeat the Russians and the Iranians, they're gonna go after China. I mean, it's you can't really make this up. No one asks the basic questions. If we couldn't make liberal hegemon work in the 90s when all power was concentrated in the West, why is it such a good strategy to try to knock out Russia, Iran, and China in order to restore it now in 2026? It's suicidal. But again, we had a whole political class growing up for 30 years around the idea that they would rule the world and it would be for the betterment of mankind. So it's hard to give up on this, this mission.
I mean, you're right. What do you think? We see this. Well, the Germans are the worst, but not all the Germans. You don't see this at this level. Actually, you barely see any of this insanity in the East Germans. But the West Germans are rabid, foaming at the mouth. I mean, true, 30% of them support the alternative future for Deutschland, but 70% support the Uno Party, the Uno War Party. Why do you think the Germans are the most rabid? I mean, the English are always playing games. We know that. But the Germans, they seem to be absolute true believers, whether they're in the EU government or they're in Berlin.
Well, it depends when you say Germans, because the most popular party now is AfD, and that party was established quite kind of recently. I mean, I think it was in 2013. And if you listen to the leader saying, the first thing we should do is improve relations against with the Russians, and then we should drop by Kiev and ask Zelensky for all our money back. This has been a disaster. So I don't think it's all the Germans, but I do think that the German government, is completely out of control. And you kind of see this now with Merz. I mean, he's the most unpopular leader now in Europe, and he's competing with people like Macron and Starmer, which is it's quite a horrible prize to hold. So it's not as if the Germans are all happy with who they have the leading them either. So no, it's a very dangerous situation to put themselves in.
But the German elites, I mean, okay, so the average German on the street, he may not realize, or he may think that things are going to take care of without ever expanding that point. But the German elites, I mean, look, a prime example is the CEO of Rheinmetall. So in back in 23, when Rheinmetall said they were going to send their tanks, he comes out with, we're going to send 88 Leopard 1s, and we're going to send 14 Leopard 2s. 88, 14 are prime and neo-Nazi symbols. 8, 8, 8, 8th letter being H, Heil Hitler, and 14th being the 14 words of Hitler's purity speech. This is as big of a signal as you can send, who you represent. And this is the well, what we call the cream of society, in at least for the West Germans.
Well, I'm not sure what's happening in Germany anymore. I think that there's some panic because, again, I think their entire economic model, development strategy, the whole post-war identity was tied up to a model which is gone. That is, as they said during the Cold War, the Germans kind of recognized that their the rise or power or history, that it would always be distrusted in Europe. So it was made always clear that German power had to be always clothed in the mantle of Europe. That is, it had to always stand on two pillars. That is, on NATO and the EU. As long as the Germans, clothed themselves in the clothing of Europe, then it would be okay. Then they would, this was at the heart of their positive development, which the rise wouldn't terrify the other Europeans. Ironically, it's Otto von Bismarck who once made a comment that the people who use the word Europe, they use it because they do not dare to say it in their own name. And I think that's what the Germans have done as well. Anyways, what we see now is that the liberal hegemonic moment has come to an end. What's happening? Well, NATO probably won't survive this. At least it's not going to exist the way it did before. The Americans will have different interests. Even if they still want to be in Europe, the interests of the Europeans and Americans will diverge more and more. So far, the European goal or strategy has simply been to, well, let's make ourselves more valuable for the Americans by being more obedient in terms of being used as frontline states, in terms of accepting more unfavorable economic deals, in terms of politically, submitting themselves more to Washington. But this is a very temporary solution because all that Europe is doing is making itself weaker and weaker. And this is, of course, just making America less interested in Europe. So Europe is on this one. Well, NATO is not going to last. The relationship with Americans is going to go worse and worse. And then you have the EU, and this isn't going to last either. The EU could have had a future as a geoeconomic club that is using collective economic bargaining power
Right.
for a strengthened position vis-a-vis other large powers. But the EU traded this in for geopolitical EU, which is we don't need the economic cooperation. What we need is a common enemy, and this is Russia. Now it happens that this kills off geoeconomic Europe because the Europeans no longer has the access to the cheap energy from Russia. We also don't have the access to the large Russian market. And instead, Europe is now a redivided continent, militarized, at war, and it becomes more and more dependent. So no, the EU will begin to fragment, also because the Americans tend to function as a pacifier, and NATO will. So what happens to Germany now? They don't know what to do. Now they're going to become the largest army in Europe. That's their goal. Not every European
Wait,
is happy
wait,
about this.
wait. Let me one thing to ask you for that. Is that going to be the largest army in Europe by EU standards or larger than Russia?
Yeah, when they say Europe, they mean EU. They
Okay,
forget.
okay.
Yeah. But
That's easier
here's
for
the
them
problem.
getting the other goal.
Yeah, but only a few years ago. Now Germany was a different country. It was the one who'd learned from World War II. It was going to be more peaceful. At least that was the rhetoric. I don't know. I was in the army when NATO bombed Yugoslavia, so I remember 10 years after unification, the Germans
Yeah.
bombing another European capital. So I'd never really bought into how the Germans learned from World War II. I saw a different rhetoric. I remember there for. Foreign minister make the point that, oh, we had to in Kosovo they had to choose between Auschwitz and what was it, Auschwitz and I forgot. Anyways, and they decided, well, in Kosovo they said, oh, well, it was our special responsibility to act. So
I remember
how the
that.
distribution of power tends to dictate ideas. And so for the
Yes.
Germans throughout the Cold War, they said our brutal genocidal history, it was a reason why we had to be constrained. And then after the Cold War, when there was no constraint on Germans, they said, oh, actually, our genocidal history gives us, he said, a special responsibility to prevent it from happening other places.
By
So now
committing
instead of
it.
constraining the Germans, this was used now as a reason why they had to act more forcefully. So, this is how countries work. They will find their own reasoning.
You're right. And humanity is nothing if not a master of reasoning, especially when it comes to committing sins that it needs to reason out as actually being good things.
But if I can jump in there, if you want to look at German history, because yes, you can say it's different periods, different ideas, values, identities. But if you look now at the war with Russia, and especially the Germans, how they're managing Ukraine, how much consistency there is in in history, because if you go back to if you go back to World War One, the the peace deal that well essentially took Russia out of the war, the Russian
Yeah,
Empire, Brest-Litovsk.
Brest-Litovsk. Yeah.
This was framed in Germany as, oh, we're going to help the Ukrainians. We're going to, give them freedom from the Russians. This whole idea. But every historian, well, more or less every historian, there's a very wide consensus that the Germans were simply not giving, acting out of altruism, helping freedom of Ukrainians. They were looking to build a Slavic proxy. On the on the outskirts of the German Empire, something that could be used against Russia. Then you saw World War II, more or less the exact same thing. They begin to cultivate Ukrainian nationalists who saw Russia as the empire that would prevent its independence and sovereignty, and essentially aligned with them. And again, Germany would help Ukraine, but really building a proxy they can be used. And now, of course, we're back at this. That is, NATO claiming, oh, we want to help Ukraine. But at every turn, we see what was done when they toppled the government, they toppled Yanukovych. They didn't have support by most Ukrainians. Even BBC acknowledged this. At every turn, undermine every peace deal, every election. Keep in mind, 2019 was a peace platform of Zelensky.
Yes.
They undermined this as well. And even now, they see the vast majority of Ukrainians wants peace talks to put a quick end to this war. The Europeans won't even talk to Russia. They refuse to pick up the phone. And you can have, the Merz, his German leader, standing and going, oh, we're going to help fight the, we're going to stand with the Ukrainians till the end, and all this nonsense. No, they're building a proxy. It's nothing about to do about helping. There's no empathy here. And no, so. There's some very impressive, almost historical continuity, but yeah, here we are.
Well, and I'm gonna end on this, but you're absolutely right. A, B, if you look at it a little bit deeper and historically, first of all, Hitler wasn't building a German empire. He was building the new European order, which basically European Union is just a second version of it. But Hitler didn't come up with all of this. It was actually something that German philosophers were working out back in the 1880s and 1870s as Germany was being unified. Mittel Europa, and its colony should be Eastern Europa.
Yeah, no, I agree. No, so it's again, so some of the structural issues, the reason why Germany is doing this, I think that's still in play. I mean, this is why always in Europe, if you could have the Germans and the Russians find a way of overcoming this conflict, harmonizing interests, finding some political settlement, that would have to be the foundation of a stable Europe. But this is also why the maritime empires, be it Britain or their later the United States, always recognize for the same reason. If you want to maintain dominance from the periphery of Europe, that is from Britain or the US, you have to keep these two European giants in conflict. That is, keep the Germans and the Russians at odds. And they've been very successful at this. And yeah, so again, some historical continuity. I mean, that was the foundation of NATO. That is, keep the Americans in, the Germans down, and the Russians out. What has changed?
Nothing.
It's the same.
Yeah, you beat me to it because I was going to say the only way to do to keep Germany and Russia from fighting is to sink London into the Thames. So,
Yeah, no,
unfortunately.
well, they had these discussions though in Germany ahead of World War II. They were, he had I forgot their names now. A lot of generals and leading military thinkers as well who were making the point that, well, the maritime powers essentially want to have Germany as a frontline state against the Russians, while they consider whether or not they should join the land powers of Eurasia to balance off the maritime powers. Yeah, sorry, I can't remember the name now. But anyways, it's a thinking that might return one day. Maybe too
True,
late, because at the moment the Germans appear to be going down the same route, making themselves a frontline state. And It's yeah, no, I think it's gonna end in disaster unless some wiser people come in into power.
And we saw this in the Napoleonic Wars, because Napoleon's demand of Alexander I was boycott of England and its ability to trade. And then the liberals around him, it's always the damn liberals who are pro-British, they got Alexander I to finally break that treaty. And then you got the Napoleonic Wars coming into Russia. It's the English at the end of the day sitting somewhere on an island screwing things up. And get people to fight.
Yeah, well, that's the goal. If you can have other fight your wars,
Yep.
this has always been the way to go. I mean, this is why when the Iranians took power, well, not the Iranians, well, after the Islamic Revolution in 79, did the British and Americans send their troops down there to go fight them? No, to get Iraqis to do it. When it's time to fight the Iraqis, what do you do? Go fight them yourself? No, initially try to get the Kurds, trying to use the Kurds against Iran as well. If you're going to fight the Russians, you want to use the Ukrainians. If the Ukrainians won't do, then the Europeans make the mistake thinking they're sitting at the table moving the pieces around. But what they don't understand is for the Americans, they are pieces they can use against the Russians. So they Europeans can become the new Ukrainians. And again, if you're going to go after China, you're going to set up a Filipino proxy or something else. This is how imperial wars are fought. And this used to be known, but I guess not so much anymore.
Unfortunately, on that bright note, we always leave on such good notes.
Yeah.
The world is such a happy place. Hopefully, maybe somebody will realize that, or some of these other parties will finally actually grab the power that they need to grab. So, Glenn, I want to thank you. It's getting kind of dark. I'm going to phase out here. Need to find a better place and better lighting. But, Glenn, I want to thank you for joining. And let's just hope next time we talk, we can have some more positive things instead of ever deeper rabbit holes that we seem to be going down into.
Yeah, I miss the times of good news, but hopefully we'll get back there. Good to
At
see you
least a
again.
little good news. Yes, absolutely. Everybody, cheers. Thank you.